This is Kathy Diaz, your Monday host of Global Village. Join me for an exploration of Afro-Cuban rhythms from next door and around the world with other musical stops along the way. That's every Monday on Global Village from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on KPFK Los Angeles 90.7 FM.
Hi, this is Halle Berry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
I'm Margo Okazawa-Ray, your host. The crisis consists precisely of this. The old world is dying and the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters, wrote Antonio Gramsci, the Italian philosopher. We're seeing today multiple monsters, each with various heads, using ideology, coercion, and extreme violence to maintain power. There's no one way to face the unfolding tragedies. Indeed, there are and must be multiple ways. One way is activating academic institutions and their resources precisely because of their current role in quashing dissent and violating rights of pro-Palestinian students, faculty, and staff. In today's program, you'll hear from organizers of two gatherings who activated their respective institutions to face the moment. First is the Transnational Feminist Solidarities Conference organized by professors, students, and staff at the Cal State University Long Beach campus on 18th and 19th of April. In the conference description, the organizers write, "We have carefully constructed each conference panel to disrupt normative tendencies within the neoliberal university that co-opt, institutionalize, and de-radicalize feminist scholarship in politics. Invited speakers will offer critical analysis of our shared existence and how we might produce a more life-affirming world, contemplating how solidarity and collective action might be generated across geopolitical borders, identities, and subjectivities as a response to the urgency of the global political situation." I'm in conversation with CSU Long Beach professors Asa Basaruddin and Araceli Esparza to share their experiences of the Transnational Feminist Solidarities Conference. Thank you so much to both of you, Dr. Asa Basaruddin of the Women and Gender Studies Program at CSU Long Beach, and Dr. Araceli Esparza in the English Department at CSU Long Beach. I'm so happy to have you both on our program to talk about an amazing conference that happened on your campus on the 18th and 19th. So welcome to Women's Magazine.
I really appreciate this invitation.
You had a conference called Transnational Feminist Solidarities. Just the title itself says a lot. Tell us, why this conference? Why now? What was the overall purpose?
I'll give you some background. Every couple of years, the College of Liberal Arts at CSULB puts out a call for proposals to identify themes. And this process is called a thematic initiative. A group of feminist faculty, including Sabrina Al-Mohamed Wilson, Lori Baralt, Stacey Macias, and Asa and myself, put together a proposal to propose transnational feminist solidarities as the theme for the thematic initiative. Our proposal was selected by our colleagues, as the theme for the 2023-2024 academic year.
Then what happened, Asa?
So then thank you, Arcelle, for that, right? So that was the backdrop to how this conference came to be. And I think for so many of us to put together a conference, to have the luxury to put together a conference that speaks to not only the field and the work that we do, right, but a framework, a transnational feminist framework that we teach, that we practice, and that we are always talking amongst ourselves about it, and we teach it in our classes, right? But it doesn't have a presence in our college, at our university. Most folks understand feminism as seeking equality, full stop. That is just one aspect of feminism, right? And we teach at a Hispanic serving institutions where a lot of our students are first generation college students, you know, undocumented immigrants, people of color, queer, trans folks. These are folks who are political, right? But their politics is also very space-bound in the way in which they think about solidarity and activism, right? So there is sort of like a thinking that feminism, transnational feminism, is over there and not within the context of the United States. And so part and parcel of trying to bring this conference is to have the conversation, a broader conversations with folks who do the work, right? Not just, you know, not just the faculty, but to showcase the really robust and amazing work that transnational feminist scholar activists do, right? So to bring this conversation, to bring the visibility of transnational feminism to campus, because we know oftentimes feminism, gender and sexuality studies are often relegated to, you know, not just the periphery of the academic world, right? But are oftentimes seen as frivolous, mm-hmm. as, oh, just a bunch of women sitting together having conversations, right? And we know, we who do the work know that that's not the case, but that is often the perception. And for me, it's overturning that perception, you know, subverting that perception, undermining it, because we in the liberal arts, right, particularly in ethnic studies, gender studies, we do the heavy lifting of providing students with a framework of social justice about how to think about their existence, right? How to filter their understanding of social political world through a transnational framework. Even when we do the heavy lifting, we are not credited with it. We are erased in the structure of the neoliberal university, right? So this conference, in part for me and for the collective, you know, is to really bring that visibility. And we hope to a certain extent that this is the first step towards greater understanding what transnational feminism is.
Well, you mentioned that you give your students a framework. You also almost literally save lives. You never get credited for saving lives, literally, figuratively. And so first of all, I just want to thank both of you and your colleagues for doing the, as you said, the heavy lifting. You just brought up such an important point. You are one of the campuses of the CSU system, which is a system, universities for the people. So this conference kind of follows that trajectory. For example, 1969 student strikes at San Francisco State that created first Black Studies program, right? And now, 50 plus years later, here you are also as a campus carving out this perspective about transnational feminist solidarities. At the same time, on other college campuses, there's a tremendous crackdown, probably unprecedented. So it took a lot of courage, I think, for you all to put something on like this. And going back to the Palestine issue, there were a lot of conversations and panels around Palestine and Palestine solidarity. That's radical in this moment. Congratulations on that. Speaking of solidarities, something that I noticed at the conference was that solidarity wasn't just here, wasn't practiced here, you know, in the U.S. for us with people outside the U.S. I saw the solidarity, you know, actions happening within the conference. So the ways in which you all really supported each other around self-care, as you mentioned earlier, around being fed. You know, I think about those kind of small as important acts of solidarity that are really important to practice in a day-to-day life.
Thank you for recognizing the care work that goes into forming the type of collectivity that was necessary to put the conference together. So I've been there long enough to have experienced the fact that we've been able to build the feminist, also radical scholar of color sort of community that we built started happening during the pandemic, when Zoom meetings, organizing remotely, became more possible, right? So we learned how to do this. For those of us who are parenting, those of us who are teaching too much, those of us who were in Southern California, so commuting is a huge issue. All of a sudden, we were able to join in community in a different way and format than we had previously. Even though the pandemic was incredibly difficult in many ways, it also created a moment of possibility for us to build community in a different way and to build connection in a different way. That's carried through to the current moment where we're in person, where we continue to seek each other out, to connect with each other, so that we're building that community of care. From my perspective, there's this kind of context in which a discussion about care work becomes possible, in part due to the pandemic. You're seeing that, right? That it's okay to love each other.
You use the L word in an academic space. What were some of the most moving, radical lessons that came out of the conference as you two experienced it and as you've probably discussed with your colleagues?
I think I want to echo a little bit the solidarity question earlier, Margot, right, that you noticed, and I think it's the solidarity and all that Arcelia has mentioned, is that solidarity that we lovingly cultivated, right, throughout the pandemic and beyond, that gave birth to this Transnational Feminist Solidarity Conference, right? Without the friendship that we've built, the struggle that we've gone through together, everything, right? Not just academically, just the basic day-to-day life about picking up kids and everything else, right? That fed into how we value each other and how we love each other. And I think that's what you see. That's the radical love that I was talking about earlier. Okay. I think for me, what stood out the most is the ways in which Palestine is central to the conversation, right? Even though we had one dedicated panel to Palestine as a feminist issue, could see it reverberate throughout the whole conference. But to be able to see the scale on this conference, to have these conversations, right? To have colleagues from other departments and staff members be present to actually listen to Palestinian feminist scholars speak not only about their research, right? But the ways in which they are existing through genocide. They are doing a conference presentation through genocide while their families are getting massacred. There is so much pain, but so much realness, right? This is their embodied realities. And to have students be a bear witness to that, we all are bearing witness to genocide, right? And I think bearing witness to that in throughout the day in the conference, to me, that is what feminism is, right? How we do feminist practice, how we do transnational feminist practice, and to be able to do it on a campus that doesn't necessarily recognize the labor of women of color faculty or the ways in which feminism is a legitimate academic discipline. It saves lives, like you said earlier, Marco. It orients students. It gives them hope. It allows them to imagine a different world, right? We can't imagine a different world alone. We need to do that's how we need to exist as a collective. And so for me, that is the most important aspect, to be able to see students have interactions with speakers who showed up. For them, it's a gift to read an essay that I assigned to them in class, but to actually to have conversations with, that is learning on such a deep, amazing level. I often think about transnational feminism as a way, as a tool, right? As a guiding force for students to understand, especially because we are in the belly of empire, in the belly of the beast, to really be able to connect their experiences to the global structures of power, right? Patriarchy is local as it is global, right? As with the ways in which capital moves. So I want students to understand that we have to work hard across difference. Audre Lorde taught us that we have to work hard across difference. And for me, that is solidarity, right? The act of listening to one another, really take in all the nuances of what they're saying.
The thing that struck me also is the presence of the artist presenters. What does art have to do with solidarity and transnational feminism?
We very purposefully, intentionally thought about ensuring that the radical imagination was present and visible within the conference space. The artist panel with Mary Hasboun, a Palestinian artist, and Irina Cervantes. We also had in the patio space as a very visible part of the conference. So we had Felicia Montes, who was one of the conference organizers and also a member of Mujeres MIAs, brought up what she calls, I think, the mobile cart making silk screens, right, mm-hmm. In that space. And Mary had her artwork there on display, and then she was also selling it. And the way students and conference attendees flocked to Mary, right, to Mary's table, and really demonstrated their connection and love of the art, I think emphasizes the way in which art connects people and helps people understand, again, collective struggle, right? So that's what Mary's art helps us think about and represents. So I'm a literary and cultural critic, right? So that to me, art and the radical imagination, literature are always central to the way I'm thinking about the world and the way in which art and writing help produce the social world we live in, so that we can have space for recognizing that the imagination is critical to getting from dystopia that we live in today to the utopic world we want to produce and we want to live in.
And that we will produce. I love the title of Mary Hasboun's collection, The Art of Weeping. The ways in which emotions and feelings played a part in the conference also was absolutely liberating, because it was a very emotional topic, the genocide in Palestine specifically.
Yeah, and if I can add to that, right? I mean, I think for our students too, you know, people have different ways in which they understand knowledge, they approach knowledge and digest knowledge, right? So for a lot of our students, having art as part of the ways in which we learn, right, how knowledge is produced is really central to how they think and view the world, right? And also, you know, just a little bit about how Palestine is centered, and we insist on centering Palestine throughout the conference, right, is to push back against the narration that Palestine is an exception, right? So it's always about social justice. We can advocate for social justice, right? We can advocate for a better world, except Palestine, mm-hmm. right? We can't speak about Palestine. It's taboo. It's not permitted. Right. So I think by doing that, right, we are also bringing a different reality that's much needed to our Arab, Muslim, Palestinian student population, right, who have been silent throughout this genocide, who don't feel that they belong in the university. I mean, universities are not made for Black and brown bodies like our bodies, right? Mm-hmm. These are not the bodies that are expected to survive. And for our students to see that, I think that goes beyond the learning that you get at a university. Right? That art is a part of the learning process.
What I'm really getting out of the conference, Transnational Feminist Solidarity, is the way in which the kind of space that you all created that was intellectual, it was emotional, clearly political, clearly activist, is so essential in this moment. How can we do more of that? What lessons should we take to create more spaces?
We do it by doing it. Do it in collectivity and together. We collectively plan the event so that one person can't be targeted. We don't let our students stand alone. When our students organize a demonstration on campus, we show up, we witness, we stand there. We're not the organizers, but we're there and we're looking and we're ready to act if necessary. And our students know that. Do it by doing it.
Azza, what do you think?
I would like to see student-led events more of a way in which students are able to have conversations with each other, and that we, you know, as faculty are there to be in conversation while thinking about how to fund an event, right? But, you know, as CSU, as I said earlier, there's always all kinds of precarity involved. How can we just come together and have a story circle, for instance, right? And just talk and just and share experiences. And I borrow this, you know, story circle from Native feminists. How do we just come together and have a conversation? It is just a space where we anchor each other, where we listen to each other, where we just be. I want to be present in that moment. I want to exist with folks. I want to be able to commune. We don't get a lot of spaces in which we are able to think together, let alone think radically, right? We do that in our classrooms separately, but I wish that we can have a larger space in which we can do that. The other thing I have been thinking about since the conference is because so many things are happening rapidly, right? And we are always on the go. We are always planning. We're always responding, reacting to what is happening. Sometimes we're not documenting what is currently happening, how we're responding to it. So I worry about documentation. We learn from the amazing radical feminists, right? And we learn because we have documentation. So I wonder in this moment, what are the ways in which we can embark on that documentation, right, without overtly taxing mm-hmm. our already taxed bodies?
Mm-hmm. Very yeah. important point. I think in this moment, we need methodologies, including questions like, what are we confused about? What are we flummoxed about? Through these little spaces that you just described as a kitchen table conversations, documenting those and coming up with new understandings of how to do something together, collectively, transnationally, and in solidarity.
You know, I love the question you posed to the closing plenary, right, to Chandra, Karma, and Nada. What are you confused about? Actually, it's a heavy question, right, Margot? I mean, you know, folks were laughing because it's such a beautiful way of asking. That is the question we should be asking, right? Because particularly in this moment, there's a lot of confusion about everything. My students can't even articulate what they're confused about because there's so much coming at them, mm-hmm. right? And that's just the student body, right? But even us as faculty who are supposed to be the anchor, we are also confused. We have a lot of mixed feelings. We have feelings of rage, feelings of anger, feelings of hopelessness. What else can we do? What else should we be doing? Right. And no way in which to express these things because, well, then you become uncivil. Mm-hmm. Right. In the context of the university, you become the problem. Mm-hmm. And so I think asking that question, right, what are you confused about, actually opens up our imagination, makes us become killjoys. Right. In the words yes. of Sarah Ahmed, it's really important that we become killjoy. And I think of your question, Margot, as a window into, as you know, as opening up a space in which we can enter into it with all the killjoy narratives that we have.
Big cheers for good questions and uncovering things that we're confused about. Going forward, any ideas going forward?
For me, the conference was revitalizing. It gave me renewed perspective and possibility about what the types of spaces we can create in the university, thinking about how to create more spaces like that, how to ensure that our students have the types of spaces they need to engage with the critical questions of the day, and also spaces where they can ask the questions or learn more about the things that they're confused about. Just as an example, yesterday in class, one of my students asked me, you know, a lot, there's such a large police presence when you go to a protest. And I'm always concerned. He's he's like maybe over six feet, heavy set guy. So he's like, I'm always concerned that I'm going to be seen as the threat or the target. And I'm going to be the one that's going to be arrested, right? He was able to ask that question in the context of class, in part because we've created collectively, my students and I have created a space where those types of questions can be asked, right? And so the again, creating the types of spaces that you're describing, Margot, where we can ask questions without being concerned about being seen as incompetent, unprepared, unworthy of being in the space, all these things that happen, right? What people might call imposter syndrome within the university. Right. I think that would be something that I would like to see moving forward, both within the classroom, within the university, and beyond. Alza, I would love to hear what you were going to say.
But I would like more conversation with the community, community organizations. I want that dialogue. I want to see feminist conversations happen in that way, right? I want our students to be able to take what they learn, right? And I want folks through their organization, folks in the community to come talk to us, right? To ask the kind of questions that maybe they can't ask somewhere else, right? So to be in dialogue, to have that conversation, to make this, to normalize this, like it's normal to do feminist praxis, mm-hmm. right? And yeah, and I want that. And I want to envision how to do that collectively.
Thank you so much for the space you've created, Dr. Azza Basiruddin and Araceli Esparza from CSU Long Beach. Thank you so much for being in this conversation with me to share your reflections, and most of all, for the ways that you all have created an amazing space for yourselves, students at CSU Long Beach, and for others who are lucky enough to come into contact with you on campus and off campus. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us, Margo, and thank you for helping us create the space of the conference.
Ser tu gran amiga, incluso tu compañera de vida. Yo puedo ser tu gran aliada, la que aconseja y la que apaña. Yo puedo ser cualquiera de todas, depende de cómo tú me apodas. Pero no voy a ser la que obedece, porque mi cuerpo me pertenece. Yo decido de mi tiempo, cómo quiero y dónde quiero. Independiente yo nací, independiente decidí. Yo no camino detrás de ti, yo camino de la para ti.
Tú no me vas a humillar, tú no me vas a gritar. Tú no me vas a someter, tú no me vas a golpear. Tú no me vas a denigrar, tú no me vas a obligar. Tú no me vas a silenciar, tú no me vas a callar. No sumisa ni obediente, mujer fuerte, insurgiente, independiente y valiente. Romper la cadena de lo indiferente. No pasiva ni oprimida, mujer linda que das vida. Emancipada en autonomía, activa, reacta y alegría.
Ser protagonista de nuestra historia y la que agita la gente, la comunidad, la que despierta la vecindad, la que organiza la economía de su casa, de su familia.
Mujer linda se pone de pie y a romper las cadenas de la piel.
Tú no me vas a humillar, tú no me vas a gritar, tú no me vas a someter. Tú no me vas a golpear, tú no me vas a denigrar, tú no me vas a obligar, tú no me vas a silenciar, tú no me vas a callar.
No sumisa ni obediente, mujer fuerte, insurgiente, independiente y valiente. Romper la cadena de lo indiferente, no pasiva ni oprimida. Mujer linda que das vida, emancipada en autonomía, activa, alerta y alegría.
Support comes from the Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning June 1st through October 20th, with outdoor repertory theater and educational programs for all ages. The Theatricum's signature production of Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream is back, alongside The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, a fresh take on the J.M. Barrie classic of a boy who wouldn't grow up, Tartuffe Born Again, a new translation and adaptation of the Molière masterpiece, and the Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latine Vote. The Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum is located in the heart of Topanga Canyon, just off the 101 freeway in the shade of the California Live Oaks. For further information and tickets, visit www.theatricum.com or go to kpfk.org.
The benefits of donating your used vehicle to KPFK include funding new and existing programming, as well as increasing community awareness. You also benefit by being able to reduce your taxable income. There's no need to deal with the hassles of selling it, and you support public radio in the process. To donate your vehicle, please call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org.
I'm Mimi Gastelum. Today, we're bringing you the birth story of America's first home pregnancy test.
It was just amazing. I thought, well, how simple that would be. All you need is a test tube and a mirror. And and a woman could do it herself.
That's Margaret Crane. She goes by Meg. In 1965, she was a graphic designer, only 25 years old. At that tender age, she got it in her mind that instead of asking a doctor for a lab test, people could do pregnancy tests at home.
Just as a woman, I thought, why couldn't you know this yourself and not have some authority tell you this?
The story you're about to hear was produced back in 2014 with the help of our friend, reporter and producer Anne Noyes Sanny. In this story, you will hear Anne and me repeatedly say women, referring to people who can become pregnant. Back then, we failed to include those who can become pregnant who don't identify as women. Since 2014, we've both adjusted our language, but we wanted to mark that former oversight up front here.
This is where I work. It's my office. It's my,
That's graphic designer Margaret Crane. She goes by Meg, and we met in her apartment last year. It's sort of one of those cozy New York apartments where the living room and the dining room are the same room, and you go in the kitchen, you open the fridge, and it's the wall. So you go back into her bedroom, and there's this box taking up really precious space in the closet. And inside it, there are about 20 smaller boxes, like about the size of a smartphone.
Pushing it out, but it doesn't matter. Oh, it's an upside down. Okay.
And those are the very first home pregnancy tests, the ones that came out in the 70s.
And there's still some of the original ones here, so that's what they're like.
And Crane has these because she designed them.
Right. She's not just a collector of pregnancy tests. And she has all these tests left over in that box, but really there isn't anything else in her apartment that identifies her as the inventor of this billion-dollar industry. So no awards, no plaques, nothing. It kind of makes you wonder what happened. So Crane studied graphic design at the Parsons School of Design, New York City, famous school, but she left before graduating and started freelancing all over the place.
And in 1965, she went to work designing packaging for a pharmaceutical company in New Jersey. The company was called Organon, and Crane generally sat at a desk for her job there. But
once in a while, I'd have to go over to the laboratory for some reason. So I was there, and there was an older gentleman there, Dr. Slade, who'd been there for many, many years. And he showed me these tests and how they were done.
This casual tour of the lab happened in 1965. Crane was 25 at the time, and she was the only woman in the lab that day.
There were a couple of secretaries, you know, that the executives had, but it was, generally speaking, a very highly male-employed company.
So she entered the lab that day, and she saw
a long line of test tubes and a metallic metal surface underneath them, angled underneath them. And someone explained that they were pregnancy tests.
Okay, so at the time, a woman couldn't just go get a pregnancy test at a pharmacy or even at her doctor's office. In fact, a woman could only get a pregnancy test done in a lab like this if a doctor ordered it. And a doctor would only order it if there were something wrong with her pregnancy. So back then, women basically just waited to see if they got big, and that's how they knew for sure that they were pregnant. Okay, back to the lab.
And so all these rows of test tubes were different women, and they're being tested for pregnancy or not. And looking at that, I thought, it was just amazing. I thought, well, how simple that would be. All you need is a test tube and a mirror. And and a woman could do it herself.
Crane went home and she started working on a model for a home pregnancy test. Her first attempt was based around this small plastic paperclip box that she just happened to have on her desk.
Just as a woman, I thought, why couldn't you know this yourself? You know, for all purposes, you know, if you were young married and wanted to find out you know, what's going on here? Are you pregnant or not? You know, why wouldn't you want to know that right away? And if you weren't married and were worried about what you'd have to do if you weren't, you'd still want to know soon. I mean, it's as simple as that. And just sort of, you'd want to know, period. You'd want to know yourself and not have some authority tell you this.
She worked on this project in her spare time. She was kind of obsessed. In fact, the night that she finished it was New Year's Eve. And that evening, Crane went to a party with friends.
And I went like 5 minutes to the party. And I just left the party and I spent the whole night trying to make this right. And that's when I finally finished the design on the desk. And I, you know, brought it in. And the man who I brought it to, he started asking me to call so-and-so. He thought I was a secretary, and so I was to, you know, do this or that for him. And he looked at it, he was sort of smiled. I think he sort of, you know, sort of laughed and said, you know, that maybe somebody else could do this, but we can't.
So part of the problem was that these lab pregnancy tests were like half of Organon's business at the time. And the company, they weren't into taking crazy risks and compromising so many of their earnings by changing their whole business model. So marketing tests to women directly just seemed kind of crazy.
Yeah, that's right. That's true. But the other problem or problems were a little bit more tangled. The company wasn't sure how a test like this would be received socially or by the medical community.
Yeah. We have a friend, Jesse Oshinkel-Grin. He's a researcher at the University of Cambridge, and he actually studies that. He studies the history of pregnancy testing. And he pulled out this clip from a newspaper from England around 1969, which was right around the time that medical labs there started offering pregnancy tests that you could get without a doctor's prescription, which was crazy and revolutionary. And the doctors there, of course, were not happy. So here's Jesse reading that newspaper clip from 1969.
Women who apply for pregnancy tests to pharmacists instead of visiting their doctor may be risking their lives, the British Medical Association warned yesterday. So this is a radical statement. It's not coming from a kind of quack or a fringe doctor. It's coming from the British Medical Association. I mean, this really does sound crazy today, but, you know, the article continues that women who are not happy about a positive result might do something drastic like commit suicide, right? And that pregnancy, moreover, was a too serious matter to be left to self-diagnosis and treatment.
Okay, so we talked to Wendy Klein about this. She's a professor at Purdue University, and her work focuses on the history of women's health in the U.S. And she did confirm that American doctors felt pretty much the same as their British colleagues.
Part of the doctor's role is not only to provide medical care, but often with a moral tone, that they're not simply dispensing advice or prescription, but they're going to let their patient know if they disapprove of the sexual behavior.
Did you have any personal experience with, but like before you were sort of working on creating your own design for the test, did you have any personal experience with any kind of pregnancy test?
I'd never had to have my urine sent to a test, and I was lucky in that respect, I guess. But I'd certainly worried a few times whether I was pregnant or not, yeah.
And if you had to go to a doctor as an unmarried woman and sort of go through the procedure for testing, like how, like, can you imagine what that would have been like for you at that time?
A friend who had found a doctor who was very helpful to her sent me to a doctor who put me on birth control pills because he was very open to doing that. But not all doctors would have at that time. They just came around in the early 60s, and so not every woman was. You'd have to be married. Let's say your doctor would consider they wouldn't give them to you unless you were married. This happened a lot.
Why would you have to be married to have birth control?
Well, yes. this is our society, right?
So clearly you're not having sex if you're not married.
Of course.
Yeah. And people really believed that.
I guess I hope that maybe if they came from a certain background. I think the state of Connecticut at that time still could not sell birth control in the entire state. This is in the 1960s. And this happened in other states. It wasn't readily available, period. Yeah.
Remember, women's reproductive stuff was really hot in the 1960s. In Great Britain and the U.S., the pill and elective abortion were fiercely debated. Jesse told us non-medical pregnancy testing was debated right next to these issues.
Pregnancy testing was really bound up and caught up in much broader debates around women's rights, control over, women's control over their own bodies, around reproduction, abortion, and contraception.
Wendy Klein, that professor you heard before, she said women were rallying around these reproductive issues because they were seen as the most basic rights, rights over their bodies.
This idea that they could understand and have information about what their bodies were doing without somebody else telling them that their bodies were doing it was literally a revelatory moment, because it meant individual women could have more control over their reproductive lives and thus their lives more generally.
So for women at the time, there was so much at stake and also a lot of pushback from churches and doctors.
And that is the climate in which Meg Crane tried to make a home pregnancy test.
And that's, just what was going on outside the company. Inside Organon, it really wasn't much better. So we talked to this guy, Arthur Cover. He's one of Crane's old coworkers. And back in the day, he worked in advertising, and Organon was one of his accounts.
What was Meg like? She was very pretty. She's very self-effacing, very quiet, and she also is very talented, as we found out later.
Arthur admits women weren't treated all that well at Organon. But then again, they weren't really treated well anywhere at the time.
Even I, a chauvinist male, cringed at some of the stuff that went on, especially in the ad business.
So not just Organon, but just generally in the business world at that time, the way women were treated?
Yes. Women were treated as either processors of data or potential sexual predatees.
That's gross.
So given that, it's not really all that surprising that the big wigs at Organon didn't really take Crane or her idea very seriously.
But she didn't give up. And after she was told no, Crane kept pushing. And finally, one executive actually listened a little bit.
And at one point, one of the executives went to the parent company in the Netherlands for a meeting, which they do pretty often. And he came back with some funds for it because he brought it up to the Dutch, and they were so, advanced in that way.
Crane says the Europeans were a little bit more progressive about reproductive stuff. In fact, they already had a similar home pregnancy test in the works over there. So they gave that executive some money to get it started here in the U.S.
And that's when they hired other designers to create prototypes for a home pregnancy test. Yes, the test Crane had come up with and built and pushed so hard for.
And there was to be a meeting in the conference room where these people would be showing their work. And I was allowed to be in that meeting. So they put their work on the table, and I put mine.
Organon invited their new advertising team to this design meeting, including Arthur and another ad guy named Ira Sturtevant.
And he walked down the table and picked mine up, and he said, "Well, this is what we're using, isn't it?" And an executive said, "Well, no, that's just something Meg did for talking purposes." At that point, I thought, whoa. So, Yeah, from then on, I kind of realized that I wasn't really going to be getting much credit whatsoever for it.
But did they end up using your design?
Yeah, sure, yeah, they did. They had, as a matter of fact, they said, because the other designs are really not good at all, they weren't scientifically right, they weren't, you know, they were very feminine-looking little things you would get bobby pins in or something. And I'd asked about producing mine, and they said, well, yours would be much too expensive. It's very elegant. That's for the wealthy woman. And so I took off from work, and I went around to plastic companies and in the Bronx and Newark and all kinds of places. And I finally found a company that came in with a price that was so much less than any of the ones the other designers work. So they had to do it. I think that's how it happened.
Eventually, the company also thought it was the right design, and they bought the patent from Crane.
For $1.
They had a little signing ceremony in the outer lobby in the offices and had all the paperwork there for me to sign. And I signed my rights away. I was to get $1 for that. And, but I was just very thrilled that they were going for the patents, which I couldn't do myself. You know, I couldn't afford to do it. So, I was compensated later because a company came to my husband and me to do the test market in Canada. So we got paid for that.
That's right, folks. It started in Canada, not the U.S. But first, remember that other ad guy, Ira Sturtevant, the one who walked in and grabbed Crane's design? Well, there's a little bit more to that part of the story.
When he walked in that day, I fell in love with him at that moment. And we hadn't met yet. And I came home and told my roommate in New York that I'd met the man I was going to spend the rest of my life with. That's what happened. The rest of his life, certainly. So, and then we started working together. That was January. And by July, we were living together, so.
They rolled out a marketing campaign for the first home pregnancy test. That was in Canada in the early 70s, and they called it Predictor.
But right away, they hit some bumps.
Some ministers across Canada got up in their pulpit and just said how terrible this was, and another, you know, shade of evil coming into women's lives to be able to do this. I mean, we got really nasty letters from people, too. But for the most part, we got some good press. Some of the letters that came back were women saying how thrilled they were to do this themselves.
Eventually, the test made its way to the U.S., and the rest is history.
By the way, we did reach out to Organon's current parent company, which is Merck, to get their side of the story, but they declined to comment.
You're listening to Making Contact. Just jumping in here to remind you to visit us online if you like today's show or want to leave us a comment. We have more information at radioproject.org. And now, back to the show.
At this point, Meg Crane had come up with the idea for a controversial, revolutionary product. She designed a prototype for it, she sourced materials for it, and she rolled out a marketing campaign for it. And at this point, she's not even 40. What have you done with your life? Can you compare?
Yeah.
Anyway, so after the marketing campaign,
yeah,
the test caught on here in the United States, big time, right?
Yeah.
Now they're everywhere. You can go in any pharmacy and get a pregnancy test that you can take by yourself in your bathroom or wherever you want.
No big deal. Yep.
It's very convenient. And it made a lot of money, made a ton of money. It's like $1.68 billion of pregnancy tests are sold globally each year.
Damn. Wow.
Yeah. It's insane. It makes a ton of money. And it also changed the way that women learn about their pregnancies, obviously. But, and here's the but Margaret Crane, she never really got any credit for her work.
Which is crazy, right? And it's not like there weren't opportunities to give her credit. I mean, a few years back, the National Institutes of Health put together this really comprehensive history of the pregnancy test. It started in 1350 BC,
1350.
That's right.
And it 1350.
1350.
Pregnancy test in 1350. What's that look like?
You know, I don't remember. I think it was like peeing on like sand or something. I don't know.
Peeing on sand.
And it went from 1350 BC all the way up to 2003, which is when Clear Blue Easy's digital home pregnancy test came out. And in that whole timeline, not a single mention of Crane.
That's terrible.
Yeah, right? But then in 2015, that prototype she made with the paperclip box, it was put up for auction.
Margaret Crane, first home pregnancy test. There it is. No guarantees
offered. Before the bidding started, a rep from the auction house asked Crane what she wanted to earn from it.
I said, how do you, you know, put a value on something like that? And she said, well, $5,008. And I said, well, how 6 to 9? Because Ira's birthday was November 6th and mine was the 9th. So that seemed like the only way to do it.
Any more? $9,500, I can and will sell at $9,500. Tom will be out at $9,500. Last call at $9,500. Sells to you, Christina, 4660.
The buyer was the world's largest museum complex.
That's right. Now Crane's invention lives at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C.
So we're going to walk down the hall to our storage room.
Alexandra Lord is the chair and the curator of the museum's History of Medicine and Science collection. She is now the keeper of Crane's prototype. And Lord wears these white rubber gloves while she carefully removes it from the humidity and light-controlled cabinet where it's stored now.
And if you look at it, it's not very sexy to look at. In many ways, it's very simple and straightforward. It's basically just a plastic box with a mirror on the bottom, an angled mirror, and two test tubes. It was very simple to use. It actually took just a few hours. And the predictor and the company which produced the predictor claimed that you could have this probably within about 4 or 5 days of being pregnant, you could actually make a determination. And since most doctors and most patients didn't go to the doctor to determine whether she was pregnant or not until she had been pregnant for several weeks, this was just a major breakthrough in how early a woman could learn about her pregnancy. Second, it's a really interesting comment on how someone who's not a scientist, Margaret Crane was a graphic designer, can play a major role in getting a scientific product into the hands of the general public.
Remember Jesse Ilshinkel-Grin, the researcher at Cambridge? He says that without Crane, we may never have gotten a home pregnancy test in the U.S., or at the very least, we would have waited a lot longer.
You know, the science was sitting around for a decade, you know, before Meg turned it into a home test. I mean, just because the science is there doesn't mean it's going to be used by the people that need to use it. And I really think I really want to emphasize that it's not, you know, it's not like the design is an optional add-on to the science. And I mean, I really think without the design, the science was nothing. It didn't make home pregnancy testing by itself. It really did need the design.
Remember Arthur Cover, the ad guy who worked with Crane at Organon? The first time he saw her prototype, he says he knew it was special.
It was dynamite.
Dynamite in a bad way.
Dynamite can be used to construct dams as well as blow down buildings. I could predict the fact that it would create a need that was always there, but had never been crystallized. That's the thing. It's sort of like something like this crystallizes a need that people aren't really aware of.
Okay, well, let's be honest. Clearly, some people were aware of this need. I mean, it seemed really obvious to Crane, right?
It did. It seemed really obvious to Crane. And maybe that's the point, right?
Yeah.
Like, maybe any woman would have walked in there and been like, this is really obvious. And women and people of color are still way underrepresented in science and engineering.
Yeah.
And maybe if more labs had more people with different perspectives, they'd be able to figure out how to create the next billion-dollar industry. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Amy, I got to say, does this sound familiar to you at all?
It sounds very familiar.
You know, here we go again. A woman with a great idea works her ass off to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then she gets no credit, no money, nothing. You know, everybody else benefits, mm-hmm. including a bunch of people that don't really deserve to benefit. I mean, let's be honest. We benefit, we the women who use the pee sticks.
I do. Thank you. Thank you, Margaret Crane.
Good for us. Thank you so much. But also all those pharma guys that made billions and billions of dollars, they benefit a lot, probably more than us in some ways. And Meg, she's the mother of this industry. She made this industry possible because all those guys didn't understand the importance of selling to women. And she did.
Did you have a sense this changed things for women first in Canada, but then eventually in the 70s when it came here, how it changed women's lives?
Well, I remember being at parties or groups of people and a woman saying, you know, for instance, oh, I just took the pregnancy test and, you know, John and I are so thrilled or whatever, you know, things like that. I heard a lot of people saying they'd taken them. They didn't know that I was involved with them, that kind of. So that's just kind of fun to hear that. And young women that I did know who knew that I was working on it told me what it meant to them to take the test. So I think now I'm very proud of that. I'm very happy that happened, that I had part of it.
And has the company ever sort of acknowledged or credited you in any way that isn't financial?
No. Yeah. People didn't know I've done this you know, I don't want to go bragging about it. It was very, very hard to keep it back. Sometimes I do want to tell people, and you know, this has been done, and it's, you know, Smithsonian has it, but I have to be careful.
When the auction was sort of announced and publicized, and journalists started coming and asking for interviews, was that the first time that anybody had sort of come to you and acknowledged your work and your contribution?
Yeah, yes, it was. Nobody knew, really, would have reason to know. You know, that's...
Did it feel like almost anticlimactic after so long, or did it feel like, yes, this is appropriate?
It's both. That's that crazy. It does seem anticlimactic in some ways. Because I wish Ira was here for this. I really do. That's part of it. And I'm grateful for my family to pushing me to get something done on this. I really think it had to be, and I'm 75 now. I should do something now with it before it's, you know. So I'm glad it's done. I'm glad it happened. And even for whatever credit is coming down this way, it's fine.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today, especially to Making Contact Radio. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. You can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook and on Instagram, or just email us at feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Thanks for listening.
Tune in to Canto Sin Fronteras, that is, Song Without Borders, the best music with a political edge from Latin America and the world. Every Saturday from 6 to 8 p.m. right here on KPFK.
Sintoniza Canto Sin Fronteras con lo mejor del folclore latinoamericano, el nuevo canto y la música del mundo con contenido social todos los sábados de 6 a 8 de la noche aquí en KPFK.
Hi, I'm Laura Flanders. Make your tax-deductible donation to kpfk.org today. Membership has privileges. Becoming a sustaining member of KPFK, keeping independent radio alive at kpfk.org. You can't beat it. Free speech radio can't survive without your generous support. So become a KPFK sustaining member right now. You can pledge as little as a dollar a day at kpfk.org. And thanks.